I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about craftsmen and craftswomen. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Why we make things and why it matters. That's what we're going to talk about. If you're into a particular craft, knitting, wood carving, paper making, glass blowing, making portraits out of Legos, paper cutting, painting on photographs, whatever you've chosen, please call and tell us. We don't care if you sell it or not. We'd like to know what craft making adds to your life and how you discovered it. Now listen, if you haven't chosen something yet, I have a feeling this hour is going to be inspiring. I'll tell you this, in reading the book I'm about to tell you about, I have wanted to drop everything so many times and now go be a furniture maker or be involved in some kind of craft that makes me lose track of time. So we're going to prime the pump. We have craftsman Peter Korn. He's author of Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. And he is a very good writer, so thoughtful. Peter, welcome to the show.
Faith, thank you so much.
You know, Peter, you had me thinking about this. With the internet being as pervasive as it is around the world, I wonder if the handwritten letter is now a craft item.
That's a really good question. I hadn't thought about that. I would say it depends on how you go about it, in a way. I know people who are way into the quality of their handwriting and calligraphy, so there's a discipline there, and that would certainly make it a craft object.
Well, craft for you, I gather, it has to do with a certain sense of quality, but it's so the pursuit of quality, but also something else. You write in your book, my experience has been that the effort to bring something new and meaningful into the world, whether it's in the arts, the kitchen, or the marketplace, is exactly what generates the sense of meaning and fulfillment for which so many of us yearn so deeply. So the dedication to quality, it's essential to this kind of engagement, but it's not the only component. Tell me more.
Okay. Well, I've been a furniture maker for 40 years, although these days I'm more of a teacher, and I run a school in Maine called the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship. And having been in craft for so long, I've tried to understand my own experience. And it seems to me that that when we engage in the contemporary craft work, whatever it is, including knitting a sweater for ourselves, it's not because we so much need the thing we're making or the world wants the thing we're making. It's because we expect to feel differently having gone through the process of creating an object. There's a discipline involved. There's the joy of using our own skills in craft as opposed to, for example, writing. There's the pleasure and the feedback of working with physical materials and the connection to the world around us. And all that is immensely satisfying. And there's something deep in our nature that responds to it.
I know from your story that craft found you. You had gone, you're Ivy educated, middle class kid, and you get a job working as a carpenter on Nantucket.
Yes. I grew up in a household where my father was a lawyer and my mother was an historian. I was fortunate enough to go to a Quaker school, Germantown Friends School. And in the world I grew up in, my parents' social milieu, I had never met anyone who worked with their hands. They didn't know anyone. And in their world, working with your hands moved you several rungs down the social ladder. But when I got out of college, I was just looking for a real life. And the first job that came along was as a carpenter. And after I got over the initial hump of being terrible at it, I found that working with your hands is immensely satisfying, not just because of being able to manifest the skill, but there's a lot of cognitive problem solving. So you're using your head and your hands, your skills at the same time. It's very fulfilling.
You ask these questions in the book. What is it about creative work and craft in particular that makes them so rewarding? What are the natures of those rewards? What are they like? What, as one of the other people in the book you quote, does the process of making things reveal to us something important about ourselves?
Yes. Well, if I may say where the book came from in my own experience, when I was first a craftsman for quite a few years, I was showing in craft shows, and then I started around 1980 to show in art galleries. And when you exhibit in art gallery, you have to write an artist statement. And what I was writing in my artist statements around 1980 was that I was trying to make furniture that had the qualities of integrity and simplicity and grace. Now, and those are still my design goals, really. But 10 years later, I was in a writing workshop with an art critic named Arlene Raven. And in the process of that, I realized that the reason I had become a furniture maker in the first place is I had imagined that by acquiring these skills and practicing them every day, I would cultivate more of the qualities of integrity and simplicity and grace within myself. And that led me to see that, at least for me, really, I came to my craft as a self-transformative process, a process of discovery, finding out who I was and who I could be. And I honestly believe, whether you do it as an amateur or professional, whether you ever think about issues like, who am I and who can I become, that is why we practice creative arts in the 21st century.
I wonder how broadly we could stretch out that definition. I fully respect those. That's your definition. Those are your goals: integrity, simplicity, and grace. I was thinking of a furniture maker I discovered a long, long time ago. Don't even remember the name, unfortunately. But all of his pieces, you know, the desks, the tables, all were slanted so that actually nothing could sit on them. The tops were all kind of curved and at crazy angles. And yet, standing there looking at them, they were beautiful works of art. They weren't useful. They were just meant to be what they were. And so I thought to myself, well, what is that craftsperson's goal? It wouldn't be, I don't know what it would be. Maybe simplicity, integrity, and grace, but it would have to be wit.
Oh, I wouldn't assume that anyone else's goals are my own. And in fact, you know, every one of us, artists and craftspeople included, are products of our culture. And the mainstream values or yardsticks that our culture provides for us are fame and money as measures of success. So I would say many people who are in the creative arts, it may be their goal that the transformation they're looking for is to feel richer and more famous. But I believe the work will reflect that. What the person you saw was after, I can't say. If I saw the work and I was a really adept critic, maybe I could figure out the questions that the maker was asking himself or herself when they went into the process. I look at my own creative process and that of everyone I've ever met in the arts as an ongoing exploration. We have an idea to make something. We make it. We look at it. We respond to it. We have time to sort of measure its success as a visual or other object over time. And then we make the next thing, exploring new ideas that come out of that one. So every individual object is just a snapshot of one point of a thought process that can be lifelong that a person who's creative goes through.
Of course, I'm trying to get at how useful a thing has to be considered a part of a craft. I know potters who used to make things you could do things with, you know, bowls that held fruit or food, and now they're doing sculptural objects that have no use other than to just be there and ask us questions of ourselves, make us feel things by looking at them.
That's absolutely right. In the 20th century, we had the studio craft movement, which is the movement that I and people of my generation belong to. And many of us may have started out as people with a really strong interest in learning how to design and make functional, beautiful objects. But it quickly adopted the values of its time and place, which is to say, really, making became an exploration of one's inner truth. And that's what it was. And it didn't really matter at that point whether work was functional or not for one to still, you know, if you look at a table and the top's all slanted and it won't hold anything, that's still conveying a message for what the life is like that should be lived around it. It's actually exhibiting an ironic view towards life, which is very, very characteristic of our time. And there's a lot of information there.
Yeah, I think so, too. This is Peter Korn. He's director of the nonprofit school in Maine, the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship. His book is Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. It is a great read. It's posted at our site right now. Go to WNPR.org and search programs for the Faith Middleton Show. Here's our number if you'd like to join us. If you are engaged in some kind of craft, again, Peter and I don't care if you do this for money or simply for love or a combination of the two. Call and tell us about what your craft is and why it has meaning for your life. 203-776-9677. That's 203-776-WNPR. I love this part, Peter, in your chapter 3 where you say, because it tells you something about the process for you. In furniture making, beginnings are critical. For a simple frame and panel cabinet door to stay flat over the long haul and not become too tight in summer or overly gapped in winter, success starts with the choice of timber. Not just what species or which plank, but also from which part of the board one saws the stiles and rails, how dry the wood is, the method by which it was dried, and how it was stored and handled. All this before the actual work of milling the timber flat and square, laying out and cutting the joinery, making and fitting the panel, assembling, trimming, fitting, hinging, latching, and finishing. Throughout the entire process, the quality achievable at each stage is utterly dependent on the care with which the craftsman has accomplished every previous step. Well, that's a lot of pressure. It's a good thing you get lost in all the activity.
Well, the wonderful thing about craft, I mean, the two art forms, if I may call them that, that I have personally experienced are furniture making and writing, and they're very different. And writing, words are very slippery things. They're nebulous. They're rare. It's easy to lose touch with reality. But craft keeps you so grounded in the real materials of the world, and you can't fool a chisel or a piece of wood. You can't pretend. Either a joint's tight or it isn't. Either a chisel's sharp or it isn't. And so all your presumptions and our speculations are subject to the test of the real, and I think that's one of the things that makes working with material so satisfying, is that aspect of it.
Yeah. Peter, stay right where you are. We're interested in hearing from you as you listen, if you are a paper maker, a glass blower, someone working with pottery, whatever it is that you consider your craft, whether you do it for money or not, please call and have conversation with us about that. And maybe somebody else listening hasn't chosen something yet but wants to be that inspired, we'll catch on and give it a try. 203-776-9677, and we'll be right back with the Faith Middleton Show. Find what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. Right now, you can find the book we're talking about, written by my guest, and you can find delicious recipes for dinner, value wines, easy cocktails, and much more. Click on Programs at WNPR.org for the Faith Middleton Show. You'll see the Food Schmooze link there. And this book, Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, The Education of a Craftsman by Peter Korn, my guest. Shana, welcome to the show.
Hi, Faith. Hi, how are you?
Great. Thank you, Shana. Go ahead.
I've been crafting since I could walk. I mean, I've been doing sewing by hand. I sew. I make costumes. I've done stained glass work. There's no end to crafting for me.
Did you say since you've been two?
Pardon?
When did you start this?
Oh, when I was a little girl, my mom taught me how to sew, and I just took off on my own, and I've been doing it ever since. I sell things now on Etsy. I go to Pinterest online for inspiration.
So explain what Pinterest is, because if once I get on that site, I can't get off. It's so interesting to me. Go ahead.
Oh, Pinterest is great. You can go there for recipes. I go there mostly for crafting DIY ideas. I'll see things that a store sells, and I go, you know, I could probably make that. And you just pin it to a board, and you can go back for inspiration when you're doing something.
So, Shana, do you do this for a living, or do you squeeze time out of the rest of your life?
I squeeze time out of the rest of my life. I try to sell at local craft fairs. I've gone to local shops, and I've brought in different things because I make a lot of little whimsical things with felt, and I sew them by hand. So,
is there a way, Shana, that you can describe what this gives to you in your life?
It's not only just a relaxing hobby. It's something, you know, I make it, and I just give it away to people who I know will care about it, since I've made it by hand. And it's just a challenge, because you know you can make something by hand and you can do it, and you see it somewhere else, but you go, you know, I can make that myself. So it's more empowering than anything.
Expression of the self too, huh?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
It's great.
Thank you so much, Shane. I really appreciate you joining the show.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. So, Peter, there we have it. That sense of, you know, sells some of the stuff Shana does, probably to fund some of the other craft work that she does, probably stealing as much time as she can to make that happen.
Yes, I think there are so many people like that. And one of the things, now the book has been out for a few months and I've been able to see how people respond to it, and I think one of the main things that it might be of value about it is that people who have creative passions have very little in our mainstream culture that helps them to value and understand it. We don't have an intellectual framework, again, because people say, well, how much do you sell it for? You know, how famous are you for it? And that those seem to be the only measures people think of success. But really, there is so much more to life than fame and success, and the things one gets out of engaging one's creative ability, having an idea, and then doing all the hard work of making it real and making it of value to other people too in the world. That is about as good as it gets in life.
Peter, I have this item. I call it my spoonbill. I've carried this around with me for decades, and it was so long ago. I'm in an antique store, and I see a bird that has been made out of silver spoons and forks that some person, probably sitting in a basement with some kind of welding equipment, has bent these spoons and forks in such a way that they come together and they make this quite wonderful, eccentric bird. And sitting on a kind of steel plate. And I thought, well, where did this come from? I would never part with this.
And did you buy it in any special circumstance?
No, I saw it and I was so touched that some person somewhere unknown had spent clearly a lot of time figuring this out, how to bend these so that it would resemble this bird, and did it. And every time I look at this object, I think of that creative spirit in people, all the people who are, you know, I always say in their basements, in their garages, sometimes at the kitchen table, doing the thing that makes them lose track of time is a form of expression of some kind, a sensibility about art, and takes a fair amount of intelligence and skill to do these things. I could never have made that bird.
Oh, you sure could. But you'd have to practice first. I mean, there's a lot of skills to learn. At our school, one of the premises is that anybody can learn to express or to use their creative side in furniture making and woodworking. And so in all of our courses, at the same time you're learning how to sharpen a chisel or cut a dovetail, you're also designing your first project so that you start to learn the steps of design and how to go through that. I've taught thousands of people, and I have yet to see anyone who doesn't have the ability to create something new.
Oh, isn't that great? Do you remember the first moment, Peter Korn, when you came? I know you started as a carpenter and that it was very practical and you had jobs to get done and it wasn't a big team. But do you remember the first time you reached a stage where you ran your hand across a piece of wood and thought, that's beautiful?
Yes, and it was actually before I was a carpenter. It was when I first moved to Nantucket, excuse me, and I sanded an old pine floor and then put some varnish on it. And when I put the varnish on it, the grain just popped out so beautifully. And it was just one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen up in my life up until that time.
Frank Faith Middleton with Peter Korn, author of Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. Go ahead, Frank.
Oh, I come from a family of artists and craftsperson. Two of us, there are four of us, two of us earn their livings, and the other two do it for enjoyment. I have a younger sister who is just voted the best rug hooker in all of North America.
The best rug hooker?
Yes, oh. Art rug hooker in all of North America. And
wow.
She does it for a living and travels all over North America giving classes. And you'll go to her house at nighttime, and she's got a little frame in front of her, and she's hooking something. And I said, oh, what's that? She says, oh, I'm hooking a prayer rug for someone. She hardly ever sells her pieces, and they're all very, very beautiful. Then I have a brother who's a sculptor, and he earns his living. He's a has a master's in fine arts, and he teaches, but he's a sculptor, and he incorporates a lot of his stuff into his house. He bought a house that was built in the 1700s, and he was able to use his studio, as your guest was talking about, all the little dovetailing, and he built his kitchen, and he did all that other stuff, and then goes back into his studio, and he works on his own art stuff, which has an oriental overview.
Excuse me, Frank, do you have a love of your own?
Yes, I'm a book conservator, and I took the course years ago at the Creative Arts Center in New Haven.
Yeah.
And I got hooked.
Yeah, I know that program very well.
And
wow,
I got hooked.
Yeah, I bet you did, Frank. Thank
Go
you
ahead.
So much. I was saying, I bet you did get hooked. That is a great program. Has had some illustrious teachers there. Thank you, Frank.
You're welcome.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So there's another example of people doing it for love and for money.
Yes, and I do think that it's really important to me to make a note that I meet a lot of people who think that their furniture-making activity, for example, isn't quite real unless they're selling the work. And it is true that having people pay you for the work is a certain kind of validation that what you're doing is of worth to someone else. But really, the intrinsic value of creative work, first and foremost, has nothing to do with whether you're selling it or not. You don't have to be paid for it to have it be deeply meaningful in your own life and very fulfilling.
Mark Faith Middleton with Peter Korn, welcome to the show. We're talking about craft and inviting you to call in and tell us. Go ahead. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you? Hi, Peter. I'm calling, this is a great topic, and just the importance of going out and taking a class for me it changed my life. I was lucky enough to go to the University of the Arts in Philadelphia in 1990 and just happened to take the furniture course that they were offering as an elective, and instantly that was what I was going to do for the rest of my life. So,
and has that been the case?
And that has been the case, yes.
What do you do exactly?
I build furniture in New Milford, Connecticut. Peter, you probably know James Schreiber, who's in New Milford.
I certainly do. He's taught at our school.
Yep. So I've been working with him now for 14 years.
Well, Mark, why don't you, if you have a website, tell me what it is and give yourself a plug.
Well, I am James's assistant, and that's...
Oh, that is
not
great.
Not everybody is prepared to talk on the phone and deal with the clients and stuff all day. I get to, luckily, make furniture all day.
Really nice furniture. Yeah.
And that's his site is jamesschreiber.com.
Thank you. Hey, Mark. For you personally, what would you say this kind of craft adds to your life? What's the meaning of it?
The teachers that I had were, I saw three things come out of them. There was tradition, there was technique, and there was that whimsy that you guys were talking about. I had, and I can bring that into every aspect of my life. So tradition is one of the big things that I really love about wood and furniture. And it's such a huge long.
It sounds, Mark, like the work and the training has given you, as it does for many professionals, range.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you. Go ahead, Mark.
And I just wanted to say that I recently lost one of my professors, Roy Superior. He was just an amazing person, and if anybody has a chance to look at his stuff online, it's worth a look. It's so fun and so whimsical.
Thank you so much, Mark. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Okay, it's a show on craft making, whether you're doing it for money or for pure love. We have Peter Korn with us, and he has written this book, so thoughtful and interesting, Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. And Peter is director of the nonprofit school in Maine, the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship. Peter, when I was it might have been the 70s, and I was a newspaper reporter in Connecticut, I was walking home from the office, and there was a little house, and the doors were always open, and I could see a carpenter in there working. And I walked in, and I said to the man, would you ever take me on as an assistant if I could come after work? And he said, sure. And that was my big chance. I never did follow through on that, but I, to this day, remember it and wish I had. I can't tell you how many times I've seen such beautiful pieces of furniture and bookcases and salad bowls. And I just wished that I had done that, and I could have made all these things all my life.
One thing I hear, you know, at our school, mostly what we do is professional training, but we also have lots of courses for beginners that are, you know, courses that are 1 or 2 weeks long.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear often someone will come and take a 1 week introductory course in some aspect of woodworking, and then they say, I will never look at a chair or a table or any piece of woodwork the same again.
Yeah.
It changes the way you, once you realize what goes into making something, you never see it the same again.
Well, can I quote you on that? Because you say, I think of the furniture I made in New York as a form of currency. Customers were not just buying desks and coffee tables, which they could have found more readily at furniture stores. Customers were buying desks and tables that had been designed and built by a single individual who did so with passion and integrity. This story was conveyed in part by the experience of purchasing furniture directly from its maker, but it was also conveyed by the aesthetic qualities of the furniture itself, with its exposed dovetailing, hand-rubbed oil finish, lovely grain selection, and so on. I was engaged in furniture making as a creative process, the practice of which would help me to forge a good life. The furniture I made was the currency that represented the process, as surely as the paper money of my childhood was backed by the gold in Fort Knox. That is from Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, written by my guest, Peter Korn. It's about the education of a craftsman. Lindsay Faith Middleton, welcome to the show. Hi, Lindsay, you there?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I was wondering how you market yourself.
Are you talking to Peter?
Yes.
Peter... yes, at what point did you, I know from reading the book that you did start to worry about things like that at one point.
Yes, I actually, after the first thing I made was a cradle for some friends, and then I quit my carpentry job and just started, I became a professional furniture maker not knowing a single thing, which somehow was possible in 1974. And I marketed myself in those days through the early craft shows, which is a world that has grown tremendously. Mm-hmm. And then I started showing in art galleries. But it was really hard for me to make a living. And eventually I realized that I wasn't going to have the adult life I wanted to have living on hand-to-mouth income. I just was not good at marketing or selling my own work. And so I took a job at a place called the Anderson Ranch Art Center as a program director for their workshop program. And then in 1992, I moved to Maine to start a school, which has grown into the nonprofit I run. And so in terms of how I market myself, I have there were 12 years at which I was a reasonably unsuccessful furniture maker financially. It doesn't mean that I'm not really proud and delighted of the things I made or that other people didn't love them. But we have right in our course catalog for our students, we say, so many students come with this dream of being self-employed and having a little shop behind the house and just spending their days making beautiful objects, and yet they don't see, and we try to show them that to make it work, you have to look at it as a business, and you have to do marketing and customer relations and all those things, and you have to think of your work as a product if it's going to sell, if you're going to sell it.
Peter, though, do you want to say something about that time in New York? Because you had been so isolated prior to that. And then you take this cheap storefront in New York, and suddenly you become friends with people on the block. People start dropping by. They see things in the window. That really struck me.
Well, my personal trajectory, I'm one of those people who has to reinvent the world for themselves. I see a lot of people like that still, young people. And so I started teaching myself furniture making in isolation, not knowing any craftspeople. And I can look at the entire trajectory of my life as one in which I open up more and more to learning from other people. And being in New York was a huge learning experience. I got to meet artists in other areas, and I, of course, with the storefront, interacted more with clients as well. And that was the place where I really inhabited the identity of a furniture maker. I thought of myself as a furniture maker, and the people around me did too. And that was New York for me.
So something to be said about the cross-pollination that comes from meeting people who do what you do or something similar to what you do. Thank you so much for your call, Lindsay. Yeah. And good luck to you. So we're asking, are you making paper yourself? Are you weaving rugs, making shoes, maybe designing clothes, using pottery techniques to create handmade sinks? Whatever it might be, if it's a craft to you and you enjoy it, we'd like to hear from you at 203-776-9677. And we'll be right back with Peter Korn, Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR, that's FaithWNPR, or join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to you for listening, and to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. We are going to go to calls in just a second. My guest is Peter Korn. He has written this book, Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, The Education of a Craftsman. He is a furniture maker and also director of the nonprofit school in Maine, the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship. So, Peter, I'm wondering about this thing that happens in life now where we can get our hands on great design, which is mass-produced on the cheap. I think of Michael Graves doing items for Target, let's say. And sometimes I wonder if being able to do that kind of thing, even subliminally, keeps us from making things ourselves.
I don't know the answer to that. I do know that's one of the things that makes it hard to make a living as a craftsperson, is mm-hmm. well-designed, well-made objects are available on the mass market. And one thing I noticed, as I think I mentioned earlier, I was part of something called the Studio Craft Movement, and that's a movement that's sort of aging out of the population now. But when I go to New York to something like the International Contemporary Furniture Fair, I see all these young people so excited about designing and making things the same way my generation was, but they're actually interested in the the excitement of coming up with the idea and making the first prototype, but they're smart enough that they're making things that are meant for production in someone else's shop. But in my craft movement, somehow we thought that virtue equaled, well, I should say that virtuosity equaled virtue, and we felt that the things we made could only come from our own hands, and that's what gave them value.
Sue Faith Middleton with Peter Korn. Welcome to our show on crafts. Go ahead.
Hi, Faith. Hi, Peter. I'm a potter, a relatively recent comer to pottery.
Yeah.
I started taking classes a few years ago in my late 40s at a local pottery co-op near where I live here in Connecticut. And like you with furniture, Faith, all my life I've been drawn to pottery. It just spoke to me. And I just decided one day I was going to give it a shot. And it's just been such a satisfying part of my life. I really, really love it.
Sue, you know what I'm interested in? I've known several potters in my life, and I've spent lots of hours watching them do what they do. And It is among the crafts that is the most difficult to control. Once you can have an intention, and once something goes into that kiln, something surprising can come out. It doesn't come out just exactly the way you want it necessarily. Has that been a test of your will in any way? Have you had to make peace with giving up some sense of control?
Absolutely. And one of my first teachers, who I absolutely love, taught us in the very beginning that the kiln is your collaborator and you have to embrace what it brings to the process as much as what you bring to the process. And you can't, every new potter, I think, has an idea of what their piece is going to look like, and you kind of want it to look perfect, like that bowl that you might buy at Target or Walmart. But you, after a while, you realize, no, you don't want it to look like that. You want it to look like you made it. You know, you don't want that perfection of something that's been made on a machine. You want to be able to tell that it's made by hand. And part of the cost of doing business that way is that you're going to get those little quirks that you didn't put there, but that the kiln brought to the process.
Yeah, that idea of seeing, that appeals to me, of seeing the hand of someone in something, you know, which usually ends up not being quote-unquote perfect. I love that.
Yeah.
Thanks, Sue. Thanks so much.
All right.
Okay.
Sure.
May I say something about that?
Please.
When I worked for 6 years at the Anderson Ranch Art Center in Colorado, they had programs in ceramics and woodworking and painting and drawing and photography, and it seemed to me that overall, the type of people that were drawn to each of those fields, I could feel there were differences between the type of people. And my favorites to hang out with were actually the potters, because they were the most fluid and spontaneous. I really think the type of work you do, each type of work may attract certain types of people, but it probably also teaches them certain sort of traits and approaches to life as well.
Peter, in your story, you explained that there was a time in your life earlier when you discover after being tired that you're diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma and you have about a 50-50 chance to live. Obviously, that story turned out well. Did that brush with death inform your work in some way?
I honestly don't think it informed the work, but it certainly informed my approach to every day of my life. I've ever since then, I have never been one to assume a long future, and I really love every little thing during the day. I mean, the staff that I work with at the school, I probably drive them nuts because I get so excited about lunch every day. And so that, I think, is more the sort of effect that having had cancer has had on me.
Matthias, Faith Middleton with Peter Korn. Go ahead, Matthias.
Hi, Faith.
Hi.
I actually originally am from Alaska, and I decided to pursue architecture, and I went to Portland State for a couple of years and eventually transferred to Pratt on a merit scholarship, and then went on to Cornell for grad school and the whole academic institution thing, and there was kind of this promise upon graduation that we'd be architects and we'd go work in firms and everything would work out great. And I found that working at an office, I had a really incredibly hard time, and I never really saw full projects come to fruition, and I only had such a small aspect in each project I was working on. And so in my free time on the weekends, I actually rented the garage behind my house from my landlord in Queens and started building furniture on my own. And I basically started by finding scraps of wood and old furniture legs off the street and bringing them into the garage and disassembling them and reassembling them into new configurations and making shelves and tables. And, you know, I really kind of found a great sense of autonomy in that and kind of battled with the biggest issue when you're making furniture, which is dealing with time and how much labor can one person produce by making one piece of furniture and the value of that. And I don't know, a lot of the arguments that have been raised about people asking, well, how much is this worth and what is the worth of furniture? And from this point on, I feel like I just kind of make the furniture for myself because I get most enjoyment out of that, and I don't really even think about selling it anymore.
Oh, I love that you did that from found objects.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
And Matthias, your experience is so much like my own. I was working on a carpentry crew for 2 years, and then when I went into a barn for 3 days and made a cradle, and there it was, a distinct object that I had made to my own level of excellence on my own instead of working on a crew on a house. That was so exciting. That is what drew me into furniture making.
Yeah, and I love it that you can start a project, and I usually start with a few sketches on some graph paper, and once you bring it in the garage and you start working on it, setting up a few frames for it, you get halfway through the project and you look at it and you're kind of like, well, wait a minute, this isn't quite right, and then you flip it upside down. And I've had a few pieces where I've literally just turned them over and changed the whole project, added legs on the side I'd never intended to add legs on, and kind of you end up with this whole new beast of furniture, this whole new idea that you never had a linear thing.
Oh, that is so great. Thank you so much, Matthias, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Okay. You know, Peter, my problem would be I would be so swept up in what Matthias is describing that I'd have to keep reminding myself to go back to the other parts of my life.
Oh, that may well be the case. You could have some of our students come and learning a craft is truly life transforming. They go home, they set up their own shops, and whether it's because they're going into retirement or looking for a second career, they really do change their lives.
Well, I think about our great creative thinker, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi.
I had lunch with him yesterday.
Oh, you lucky.
I was so thrilled to meet him.
Oh, and I know you quote him a few times in the book. He's so incredible. So, you know, he's the one who really got the whole culture talking about flow. And if you've ever been in it, you know exactly what that feels like. You're so lost in something that eating, all the rest of your responsibilities, everything just goes whoosh away.
I know. I can get, you know, the book is very much an effort to intellectually figure out, among other things, why that is of such value. But that is something you cannot put into words. And that is really the central joy of making physical objects with skill, is when you just, it becomes a dance of making where you are just moving from one thing to another without actually engaging your mind in any self-conscious way at all. You're just so in the moment.
The dance of making, I know that's your phrase, and I loved it in the book. Saran, welcome to the show. We're talking
Hello.
About crafts. Go ahead. Go ahead, Saran.
Hi, Faith and Peter. I have experienced a carpenter for a long, long time, since 1988, and somehow I get to the way that I come up with my own designs of designing a windmill and lighthouse. And they have a different kind of design. They're about, you know, 7 to 7.5 feet tall. And wondering, I get my question, can I marketing or some sort of copyright or patent some certain object inside a windmill, and how can I do about it?
Well, let me first just mention copyrights and patents. One thing I learned, because there was a period in my life where I actually was trying to sell designs to manufacturers, and I was very worried about people stealing my designs. And what I learned is, until your design is actually selling really well, no one's going to steal it. You don't have to really, in my experience, worry about copyrights and patents for things that aren't going to be mass-produced and aren't already in the market. Because people manufacturers rarely have the imagination, or rarely do, I shouldn't say that, rarely do they want to take the risks of trying something unknown. How you would market your object is you would go and look and find how similar objects or objects that sell to the audience you imagine for your piece are being sold. Are there websites where they're being sold? Are there retail stores around you where they're being sold? Are there art galleries in New York where they're being sold? And then you take a really good picture of what you've got, and you approach the store or the gallery or the website and put it up, and then you see what response you get. And for me, absolutely the hardest part of all this is trying to sell things, because there's so much implicit rejection in it when people aren't interested. Mm.
Yeah. Yes, go ahead, Saran.
The thing is that I've been made this lesson maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, and this product that I made is just like a material from the house that, you know, we live in. And the point is just like, you know, how the economy went down and everything. It seemed like, you know, it's hard to sell. And how do I go about to sell and market it, or someone that I can hire, or maybe I do it myself? What is the little niche of that I can do?
I'm sorry to tell you, there is no easy answer to that. The work of selling something, of creating a market for it, is probably the harder part than it is to come up with the object and make it. That's just the truth of our time and place.
Yeah, and it takes me back to the craft festivals that so many people go to. Thousands of people go to these craft festivals in all these towns, even in just starting with New England, not to mention in the city of New York. And so I wonder, I don't know what the expense is of that, but it's something to look at, I think.
I think that's true, Faith. If you can find some way to put what you've made in front of the public, it can be at a local craft show, it could be by taking a page on Etsy, you'll at least start to get feedback from some people to learn how other people see the things that you have made. And that'll be a starting place for you in terms of trying to figure out how to sell it.
Thank you so much, Saran.
Oh, thank you so much.
Good luck to you, my friend.
Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye. 203-776-9677. Katie, Faith Middleton with Peter Korn, and he is director of the nonprofit school in Maine, the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship, and they teach both professionals and first-timers, and he's author of this very thoughtful book that I've enjoyed so much, Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. It's the Education of a Craftsman, Peter Korn. Katie, go ahead.
Hi, Faith.
Hi, Katie.
Peter.
Hi.
I work with my hands also, but not nearly as beautifully as your pieces. I garden, and my choice of flowers is dahlias. And
did you say dahlias?
Dahlias, yeah.
Okay, and we have about a minute, Katie.
Okay, so every year they produce such beautiful flowers, but when the season ends, you have to, if you so choose to, you have to dig up those bulbs, store them someplace for the winter so that you can use them again next year. And I've probably been doing this for about 8 years. Every November, right before they say it's going to freeze, I'm out there digging up all my bulbs, all my babies, and collecting the brown paper bags throughout the season and putting them away. But they do give me such great joy, and giving them away instead of selling them, you know, at the end of my driveway is
oh,
much more
that's great.
Lovely. And, yeah. So what a great show today.
Thank you. Thanks, Katie.
All right. Have a good day.
All right. Good for you. I know an artist, Peter, who only makes things that disappear. And I think what an amazing spiritual thing that is. Thank you, Peter Korn, for being on the show. Love your book. It is Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. And we thank you for listening. Find the books, people, great recipes, value wines, and cocktails we feature right now at WNPR.org. Click on Programs. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.